You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Episode 138, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Hey, this is your host, Eric Larson. A little different intro today just because I'm on vacation and I'm running behind and, you know, it's just vacation. It's summer. So, apologize for things getting a little bit late, but I'm delighted to have Dr. Celia Egan with me today. You're going to learn a lot about weight management, and not only weight management, but really the different models she's using to try and approach this. As we know, in primary care, it's a hustle and bustle and hard to get those life changes that you really want to affect if you're a physician or if you're a patient, frankly, and want to have that contact with a physician that you're just not able to get normally. And so, how do you do that in today's normal system? Well, basically, Dr. Egan is working with Dr. Bittner, who you met in episode 115 in her women's health clinic. They're going to team together and they're going to just find an alternative way to take care of patients in a more personal way, in a way I think will be much more successful. So we're going to learn a little bit about the model. We're going to learn a little bit about weight management, ways to be successful, things that go into it, far more than I ever think about when I'm in the OR, since pretty much all I see with weight management is surgery, right? So this is a totally different approach and way to think about things. Also did speak with Dr. Jason Fung. You can listen to those episodes back in episodes 102 and 107, where we talked about intermittent fasting, which of course is weight control. So go back and check those out. Those will all be in the show notes. You can find those at theparadox.com/138. There you can find links to those and other things and the contact information if you're interested in getting hold of Dr. Egan. I'm almost just giddy having an opportunity to speak to someone in person as opposed to just over Zoom. So it's a nice change having someone in the studio. So for those of you who normally watch in video, I apologize to not have video because I'm basically very Gen X, and then I had the wrong video app running. So this is what happens. You don't have a full video team helping take care of things. And so anyway, it'll be up and running for the future episodes. You still get the YouTube version with just the audio, so apologize for that. And I'd like to briefly tell you about today's sponsor for the show, CareCloud. As a physician, you routinely check your patient's health. But when was the last time you checked the financial health of your practice? You could be needlessly losing money right now. Stop bleeding money. Get actionable insights about your group's financial performance with a free, no-strings-attached assessment from CareCloud, a leader in medical billing solutions, EHR, and more. CareCloud has over 20 years' experience helping large and small providers boost profitability and has helped thousands of practices optimize their financial operations. Request your free revenue cycle assessment and learn more about your group's performance by visiting drpodcastnetwork.com/carecloud. That's drpodcastnetwork.com/carecloud. But without further ado, Dr. Celia Egan in A Different Way to Manage Weight in Women. Enjoy. All right, well, welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today I'm joined in person, post-pandemic, sort of, almost post-pandemic.
Almost, hoping post, right?
With Dr. Celia Egan. Dr. Egan, thanks so much for joining the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. So we're going to talk today about weight management. We're going to talk about you as far as your journey, I guess, from where you were. I mean, we just spent a lot of time in the show talking about industrialized medicine, which is, I guess, the best way of saying that sort of the mill, I guess, that lots of mm-hmm. docs in. Especially
patient
in primary
puppy
care.
Mill, I like to call
right. the patient puppy mill.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of putting it. You can tell I'm an anesthesia. I don't hear all these primary care terms. I'm sure you guys use that term all the time. Yeah. Right. So let's go briefly in your background. So you, you're internal medicine trained.
Yep.
And then you went and got a fellowship in weight management.
So right? I just got board certified in weight management.
Board certified.
Yeah.
So exactly what did you, so how does that training work? Like,
yeah. So, medicine? Well, I had a unique situation where during my residency, one of our professors or attendings that was at our hospital was Dr. Louis Aruni, who's one of the former presidents of the Obesity Society. And honestly, like one of the grandfathers of obesity medicine, you know, someone that was sort of like, no, obesity is a disease. We need to treat it with medications. And he was an attending at Cornell, and I had the privilege of being able to do a rotation with him. So an elective.
Okay.
So it wasn't particularly anything that I had on the radar, but I was a biochem major at University of Michigan. And after doing my rotation with him, it really opened my eyes to the biochemistry, the psychology, the pharmacology that was associated with obesity medicine, and it really stuck. And so after I did my rotation with Dr. Aruni, I was able to attend our like weight management residency clinic. So basically he ran a clinic with the residents and then we did weight management through our residency, like via kind of like a separate track. So it was like a separate day that we saw patients for weight medical weight management if we wanted to. So I did that for, you know, the last, I think, year and a half of our 3-year residency. And I really enjoyed it. And after my residency, because my husband was still in fellowship, I worked as a hospitalist for a period of time, kind of as we moved from New York to Chicago, to the suburbs of Chicago. There in the suburbs of Chicago, I found a mentor who had obesity medicine and primary care practice, a small practice. And we decided to work together. And from there, I took the boards for obesity medicine, and we practiced medical weight management in a small private practice in the suburbs of Chicago.
So board certified, but usually that's a fellowship trained program, right? I mean, I feel like most board certification. So how does that, is that ACGME? I mean, how does that?
I don't think there's the ACGME accreditation, but it's a American Board of Obesity Medicine.
Okay.
Yeah. So you go to like several conferences and you sort of like an apprenticeship.
So it's especially or subspecial that you basically fell into. Kind of like it wasn't something you planned. You never thought when you started your residency. Is it pretty typical that you have internal medicine physicians who do this, or are they a lot, you're just primary care, like family practice?
It's a lot of primary care doctors. It's a lot of gynecologists, a fair number of surgeons, pediatricians, primary care specialists.
Okay. And so people you look at and say, this is going to be part of my practice. I'm going to be a pediatrician and also help focus.
Yeah.
Maybe my practice, I'll be the one who's, they throw the obesity sort of patients at me.
Well, I think that there's a big group of people that note that obesity is a huge problem, and either for personal reasons or professional reasons through patient experiences, they just want other answers to how are we going to fix this? And so how am I going to fix this for my patients? And so then they just seek out these conferences, they join the Obesity Medical Association, the Obesity Society, and that's how they just get involved, and that's how it sticks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to, I guess, you know, when you get to the obesity clinics and things like this, when you're training, you know, there's a lot that goes into obesity. I mean, obviously, right? I mean, we look at the chemistry, the you know,
the
pathology,
drugs,
right? Pathophysiology, right? There's pharmacology. There's nutrition. I mean, I imagine you're working in some multidisciplinary clinic, right? When you're training, you've got dietitians and you've got nutritionists, and surgeons and psychologists, all this.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of practice models that have had a lot of those things. They've all been run through big complexes. A lot of them have kind of failed to stay in business, I think, because the overhead's so high.
Sure.
So a lot of smaller practice, I mean, you just basically learn to do all that counseling yourself, right? Nutritional counseling, exercise counseling, you know, and then of course all the medications you get used to using and stay up to date on the current medications we use for weight loss.
I mean, when I see it, and this is just my brief experiences, I'm in an academic center, right?
Yeah.
When I'm doing my training, and I don't see it in private practice. And so just when I looked at multidisciplinary pain clinics, you don't really see many multidisciplinary pain clinics in private practice. I mean, I think there are some. They have a psychologist maybe, but you know, in the universities they got people, you know, falling out of the woodwork who do all these things, because they have their own fellowship, their own training, right? So you have all the people training for whatever it is. And so you have no shortage of labor, right? In an academic center where the private practice, you know, you have to pay for all these people and they have to pay for themselves in some way, right? It has to make business sense in order to make a run.
Right. Yeah. I think one big one big reason sometimes why it goes a bit awry is I think they lean very much on like physical therapy and really trying to optimize exercise, which exercise and activity, of course, is important. But honestly, you have to get the drugs right and your relationship with food right and the nutrition piece right first, and then kind of dive deep into the exercise portion of helping people lose weight. And so I think some of the programs that, well, the way that our private practice works is we spend a lot of time on counseling, you know, motivational interviewing, trying to make sure the drugs are all right for patients. And then we kind of outsource a lot of the physical therapy and kind of trying to optimize people from a activity standpoint.
Sure. So you don't have all that in-house. You're referring out.
Right.
Right. You don't have a gym.
A gym. I mean, right, I think, yeah. So, I mean, I think like one of the hospital centers in the suburbs of Chicago had a gym. They tried doing that, but the overhead for a gym is just enormous, you know, and they had a pool and all those things, and it just never stuck and fly enough to like make it actually find like fiscally right. able.
Well, there are lots of things that the hospitals do, I think, in hospital systems where they try and put everything, they vertically integrate everything, right? Like you say, mm-hmm. I'm going to take care of you from, you know, when you come out of your mom all the way to when you go to the nursing home and yeah. head to the ground, right?
Right.
And you can't, you can do all those things, but oftentimes you can't be efficient doing all of them, right? Like, it's like General Motors. They make the car, they design right. it. But they don't make the tires. They don't yeah. make a lot. They don't make any of the parts. They just right. put them all together. They tell you what right. we need because they find people who specialize in tool dye or whatever it is.
Right.
And so it's better to have a place where like we've got a gym and we do all kinds of physical therapy because we can't just do physical therapy just for obesity, for instance, right?
Well, yeah, and I think it's also very interesting how people want to be active is very different.
Oh, sure.
Very different, and even across generations, it's different, and so. To be able to provide, to be able to know and say to a person, you're going to do this exercise plan, like exactly the way that I think you should do it. It isn't patient-centered and it's not realistic after having counseled many, many people on how we can get them moving and strength training and stretching and a variety of different things. And so like using your car analogy, it'd be like being like, we're going to make every part for every truck, every, you know, sedan, every compact car, every convertible and luxury. And it's like, it's just not feasible. Like that just doesn't make sense because everyone kind of comes in with a different level and expectation of what exercise and activity means to them and different needs that go into that.
Sure. And yeah. I mean, taking the car analogy one step further, it's like Henry Ford, right? You can have any color you want so long as it's black, right?
Right. For exactly. I mean, a little bit. And I think that's why sometimes big systemic obesity medicine program sometimes fails is because this is our exercise program. And it's like, not right. ever, you got to be a little flexible with some of these things that people come in with and the barriers that they have.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So the listeners of the show would recognize that I talked to Dr. Dinah Bittner, mm-hmm. who will be your new partner in yeah. a couple of weeks mm-hmm. as we're recording this in late July. I'm trying to remember what month it is.
Yeah, I know, right?
And that was in episode 115 where she talked about perimenopausal mm-hmm. and, menopausal women, I guess, and just doing with women's health.
Yeah.
And I also interviewed Dr. Jason Fung for two mm-hmm. interviews. One, we talked about cancer, which is really not related at all to weight. I mean, sort of, I guess, because he would argue with growth and things, and obesity obviously leads yeah. to lots of cancers, a huge risk factor for lots yeah. of cancers. But then we talked about intermittent fasting initially, mm-hmm. when I first got interested in talking about things. So why don't you talk about what your, I guess, when it comes to weight management, mm-hmm. what is it that you're doing for patients? I mean, because, you know, Fung's focus on the intermittent fasting, Bittner obviously focuses maybe not specifically in weight loss, but yeah. or weight management, yeah. but, you know, the sort of hormonal and sort of the yeah. other changes that yeah, happen.
I think something that Diane and I very quickly recognized is that we both realized that, you know, to get people to be healthy, which is, you know, less menopause symptoms, helping people lose weight, which is, you know, some markers of health, that women need a little bit of organization to it. And so that's one thing that we try to do for women is a way to explore ways that they're having barriers from being their healthiest. You know, a lot of women sort of know what to eat, or maybe they don't know, you know, and helping them figure out what's preventing them from making those good food choices. Sometimes it's our relationship with food, right? We've been leaning, coping a little bit too much on eating. Sometimes it's just not understanding the different mechanisms and the biochemistry principles of nutrition. Sometimes it's just logistics, like really, how do I get this food? How do I cook it? How do I afford it? Right. And so we are trying to basically find all these barriers and work with patients to bring them down in a realistic way. And, you know, a lot of people always ask me, you know, do you want to do weight management? Do you want to do primary care? And it's like, honestly, it's both, right? Sure. Because it's really hard to separate those two things out. Because a lot of the things that we do in primary care, which is trying to get people to eat healthy, trying to get people to move, trying to, you know, make sure that all their other risk factors are low, ends up being primary topics that we talk about in weight management. You know, I think another major aspect, which I've sort of already talked about, was just coping. You know, how do we cope with stress? A lot of people drink and eat, right? That's kind of their main,
right.
drink, eat, and sit, right? And that's kind of their main coping mechanism. And we sort of, through motivational interviewing, try to kind of figure those things out and kind of help people see a different, you know, pathway of coping. Maybe that's new medications, maybe that's a therapist, you know, there's different apps, books, resources that we use to kind of help people out.
All right. You mentioned motivational
interviewing yeah.
twice now. I don't motivate anyone when I interview them, but
yeah.
So what exactly does that mean? Does that mean you're asking people questions in order to sort of move them in a certain direction, or
I think there's like very formal definitions in the
psychology world, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think of it more as getting patients to see sort of their own path. That's kind of how I like to think about it. Because I think that, again, I can yell at people till they're blue in the face about that they need to lose weight and that they should be healthier and they should be exercise more. But I haven't seen that that's worked out too well. And a lot of people come feeling, a lot of women in particular, leave feeling quite shameful, guilty of their habits that they have. And so kind of a different approach, which is great in private practice that you can use, is you have the time to be able to kind of pull out different things in people's and women's goals and what they really want out of visits and what they really want out of the patient-physician relationship.
So you mentioned time, and you talk to a primary care doc, unless they're in direct primary care where they have a specific, long time period between patients. No one in primary care says they have a lot of time to work out these things and to flush things out. I mean,
yeah,
that's why you left where you are, I imagine, right? In some respects.
Yeah, I think that was one reason. I think it's one's time in terms of actual length of time, like length of time with patients, and then it's time in terms of, if I have a patient and I feel like they need to be seen right away, then I can sort of make that call and have them come in or do a quick telemedicine visit and organize things to get things done for my patients and from a time management standpoint. I mean, a lot of times I think you run into barriers of staffing and there's protocols and there's a lot of things that prevent you from quickly interacting with patients in a way that seems feasible. So I'm looking forward to private practice, one, having more time to spend with patients in the room, and then also just being a little bit more flexible with the time that I have. And if I need to see someone quickly, that I'm able to do that.
Right. Well, and most people would say going private practice is not any different than being in a large healthcare system, right? I mean, you're still working within the same system. You may be your own boss in the sense that you are the one billing and coding and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So you can't possibly be going to this, to just because you're going to private practice is not going to change where you're doing it. You must have a different type of model that you're practicing, right? Because a normal private practice for primary care is what, 10, 15 minutes per patient encounter, maybe 20?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have a little bit of a different model. We have some different payment models that, membership models that kind of expand a little bit of our ability to have more time with patients and make our time flexible. We also utilize a lot of technology. So we have an app that we work within, and patients are able to communicate with us directly. And then they can relay messages relatively quickly, and we can talk back with them quickly in, you know, a matter of minutes to hours versus sometimes days that it feels like to go through the chain of command. I think a lot of it's just, you know, direct contact. I mean, sometimes in bigger systems, you're talking to so many different levels of people before the doctor actually gets the message. And it's just having a little bit of a smaller space where you just know that we're all kind of communicating within the same office space. And if messages need to be heard, that they're heard relatively fast.
Right. So you're leaving leaving the large healthcare system. We never specifically mentioned what systems we're in. Someone could figure it out if they wanted to, but essentially we're talking about all these systems are pretty much the same as far as the model that they deliver care is very similar, right? You either have a large multi-specialty physician group or you've got a single specialty group, but you're within a larger system. And so you self-refer within the system and that's encouraged in laboratories and all that stuff is sort of piled into one. But essentially the way you practice is pretty similar. And it's, again, if you, you have a certain amount of time for each patient, right? And there's a certain amount of patients you're supposed to get through in the day in order to capture the revenue you need to make pay the bills, right?
Right.
Because it's a volume-based business for the most part.
Right.
The more patients, if you don't see any patients, you don't make any money versus a membership-based, which is what you're talking about, model where you don't have to see 50 people in a day. You, if everyone's paying a certain amount and they can see you in other ways, asymmetrically or at least in person or, you know,
right.
Video,
I mean,
whatever.
I think the membership model allows you just to overall have to carry less patients. You know, I think in some of these bigger systems, doctors have to carry a couple thousand patients usually to make their quota for their overhead or whatever, you know, sort of insurance payment plan has been made up. But we're hoping, you know, to carry much, much less than that. So people feel like they can get in to see us if they're sick and actually see me, right? Versus having, I mean, I feel as though sometimes patients call and then they'll be booked for appointments and we don't, with other people, we don't even know that they're sick or what's sure. going on. And as you know, in medicine, I mean, when you're taking care of a sick person, it's not, you can't diagnose off of that snapshot, right? It's the story. It's sure. the history and it's the process of how someone got sick. And so a lot of times it seems as though, you know, people saw one person and they got a snapshot, then they saw someone else and then that was another picture. And you're like, that's what a primary care doctor's job is to put all this together and help people either fix whatever problems there or, you know, prevent illness in the future. And a lot of that is who that person is as a person. What's their cultural and ethnic background? What are their kind of beliefs about medicine? Mm-hmm. And then incorporating all of that into what's available for us in modern medicine and in some other, you know, maybe ideas about, you know, less traditional holistic methods that are safe and coming up with a good plan that the patient agrees with.
Do you, so that continuity that you don't feel like you had in the previous system, is that something in when you're a resident, you have better continuity, do you think, than as a, than when you're in private practice out of training?
Interestingly, I think I did. I wondered if that was the case. Continuity in my residency program. Yeah.
And do you think that's, is that because of just the way the models are run, or do you think it's just because those people in residency, you know, I mean, let's be honest, most people who go to residency clinics are people who can't get care anywhere else, right?
Right.
They're like,
right.
You don't care if they come for no money or you're paying Medicaid.
They don't care if they saw a doctor that literally was not a doctor like
right.
a month ago.
Exactly. Right. Do you think that's part of the reason? I mean, that just.
I'm not sure. I'm going to guess some of it is the volume of patients, right? Because if you're not a seasoned physician, they don't hand you like a 2,000 patient load, right?
Right,
I think that is part of it, that it's just volume and time. And I mean, I think your mind space isn't quite as bogged down with things. And so you just have the availability to see patients to patients. Yeah. And I think actually people who go into academics and training programs are great. They're great, smart people. And I think they do a really good job of trying to keep that continuity. I mean, during our training program, they restructured the clinic schedule all the time. And they tried to come up with different plans so that residents could see patients frequently. And so I think they're really smart people that are trying to come up with different mm-hmm. plans for how the residents can keep that continuity. And then you kind of go out into the real world where, you know, different people are running the show, different priorities, and it gets a little thrown off.
Yeah. All right. So you're moving to a new model, which is membership-based, at least in part, right? Not entirely.
Not entirely. Some parts of
you have,
membership-based.
Yeah, right. So you have some, I don't know what we'll call it. I don't even call it hybrid model.
I like to think there's different paths.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think, you know, we oftentimes look to try and explain things away as like a one system, or you want an easy explanation for what it is, or descriptor, I suppose, is a better term.
Yeah.
And we oftentimes don't, right? I mean, sometimes it's not really hybrid. It's just like, we're going to find different ways of meeting whatever need. Maybe you only need 3 months of, you know, care, whatever. We're just going to find it. We'll have a package for you.
Yeah.
That's going to work it.
Yeah. I mean, I think for instance, we have a path for, our weight, our medical weight management, which we call true weight journey, that if you want to keep your primary care doctor, you can do that. And for a small yearly fee, we'll see you you know, like 3 or 4 times, sure, just to talk about medications, quick touchdowns, really kind of circle back around just about weight management things. That's our, you know, one of our least expensive options after you've been sort of through one of the other weight management programs. And we're trying to keep pathways open for people so that they feel like they have avenues to communicate with us, but also, you know, keep the lights on and keep the doors open.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I mean, that ultimately you still have to pay the bills, right? Yeah. You have to pay the staff. How is I guess what does the research say as far as weight management programs? Like, what makes a program successful? Because I mean, I think about it, amount of time, even in this program, the amount of time you actually have with someone is pretty small. Like, you know, you're not there when they're ordering lunch or when they're most of the day, right?
Yeah.
You might see them once every other week, which is quite frequent.
Yeah.
And that's really hardly any time to sort of come up a plan. So how do you sort of manage this, things work?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's only one piece of data that is probably the strongest, which is touchdowns. The more people touch down with providers, the better off they do.
I mean, what does that mean?
I think football. Patient interaction.
Okay, all right.
I'm sorry, like touch bases. Like,
gotcha. Okay.
You know,
I was thinking football. It's almost football season.
Yeah. We're almost there, yeah. No, the more people interact with a provider, a health coach, you know, a nurse or any sort of person that's sort of coaching them along or helping them along, the better they do. I mean, even patients in these drug trials that are just on the placebo yet tend to still lose weight, which is actually kind of amazing.
Right.
Right. And so I think anything that you can do to keep the avenues open of communication between the practice and the patient, I think is going to be helpful.
Sure. And then the weight management program, I mean, what exactly is involved? Because we mentioned already that you're not going to have all those people in house. So they're just coming to see you.
Yeah.
And I imagine you're developing a plan or working with them to sort of figure things out. So what's healthy and what sort of, how do you
get to there? So how we get started is we sort of break it down to 3 things. First is, you know, meals, which is your nutrition and trying to do optimize their food choices. So when I think of making a good food choice, I think of 3 things. The first thing is education, right? What is healthy eating for you, right? What food should I have? What food should I not have, right? Timing of food. Should I do intermittent fasting? Should I not? Should I snack all day, right? And trying to find, educating on all those different factors. Second is logistics. Again, how do you cook it? How do I afford it? How do I make it tasty? Where do I get it? In Michigan, that's a problem in February, trying to find vegetables, right? And the last thing is ability, meaning if I gave you something that you believed and you and I both believed was healthy every meal, I don't know, it's Friday, it's pizza and beer night, right? Or you had a bad day, what are you going to do? Learning to deal with those social situations, those emotional situations, and better understanding of that. The second thing we do for people is mindset, which goes to a lot of ability, making sure people aren't suffering from underlying depression, anxiety, really dealing with their coping skills. We do a lot with mindfulness-based eating awareness training, or MBEAT, right? Which deals a lot with mindful eating and learning to feel kind of how our emotions are pulling us and our cravings are pulling us in one direction or another, and how not to lean on food for coping. And then medications, taking away medicines that are weight gainers and then adding medicines if we need to help people lose weight if they meet that criteria.
How often do you find the medication? So are these like actual weight loss medications? Or are you talking about just
medications that are FDA approved?
Like a Fen-Phen, sort of phentermine or something like that? I mean, no one probably uses, well, I shouldn't say no one. I have seen patients recently on that. But
yeah, so I think what you're alluding to is phentermine.
Yeah.
Which is used for weight loss. It's actually another part of a combo pill called Qsymia, which is with Topamax or topiramate.
Yep.
Phentermine, topiramate, or Qsymia. And then there's the new drug called Wegovy that just got approved, which is a GLP-1 agonist. It's very exciting. It's the data is very good. People are losing up to like 20% of their body weight, which is really exciting.
Where does that work?
So we've been using these drugs for a long time for diabetes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah, like the GLP-1s, agonists. And so basically how it works is when we eat, there's hormones that leave our GI tract and basically tell our body that there's energy here, right?
Sure.
Go to our brain or like, look, don't eat anymore. We have food here. It mimics one of these hormones. And so it goes to people's brains and it basically disassociates that call for food. People feel less hungry. They feel full faster and they tend to eat less food.
And so that kind of medication is only going to be effective if you convince someone that to only eat when you're like have reason to eat, right? Because like if people are like, oh, I'm just bored.
But see, I mean, this is the thing, right? Which is so interesting, is people just really stop doing that. It's I know that it sounds bizarre to think about, but I just have had people that will come back after being on. So one of the other drugs that is a GLP-1 agonist is Saxenda, which I've used frequently. Mm-hmm. The Wegovy, it's relatively new, like within the last 2 months. So okay. I haven't seen a ton of people follow back around with after starting Wegovy. But on Saxenda, people just tend to say, do you not think about food? Like, is this how people think about food or not think about food? Like, food consumed my thoughts and now it's gone. And which is just sort of very interesting. And that's how it works.
And I feel like when it comes to nutrition, you know, I hear people say, well, you need to know what to eat. Is there really that much confusion for people to not know what's healthy food? Like,
yeah.
Like, I think most people know, like, vegetables are probably a good idea.
Yeah. And hooray for eating vegetables. Yeah.
And not candy. Ice cream, probably not so much,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I think it's funny. I think it's a bit of a spectrum, right? So we know what's totally bad. Most people do, right? Like no one would be like Cheeto cheese puffs are healthy, right? And then for the most part, we know ideally what we should be eating, okay. Right? Like I should be mostly eating these things. The problem is, what do you do in the middle? Meaning, I don't know. Your kids have soccer and you don't have time to get all the veggies and you don't have any grass-fed beef or whatever fancy thing that we need, right? What do I do in the middle? Do I go, you know, do I go to McDonald's and just have a hamburger and throw away the buns? Or am I just going to go have, you know, like a pasta bowl? Like what direction should I sort of go in? And I think that helping people kind of navigate through these times when you don't have a perfect plan kind of laid out is imperative and kind of coming up with plan. I always tell people you need plan A, which is like you're growing your own green beans and like baking your own bread and like making your own almond milk, right? Then there's plan B, which is like, I got most of the ingredients, but I'm mostly cooking at home, right? Then there's plan C, which is like, oh, well, I don't know. I'm getting some pre-made salads and, you know, maybe a rotisserie chicken or something from the grocery store that's already packaged, but I'm putting it together. And then there's like plan D, meaning I'm in an airport or I'm at the base of, you know, the McDonald's checkout line or in the drive-thru. What am I going to eat? And kind of running through all those different scenarios to tell people they're never going to be in plan D. It's just unrealistic and unfair just because our worlds are so busy and our food system is just hard to navigate.
Sure.
And so you just have to keep getting kind of anticipating that those things are coming and then being self-forgiving when they do. And
I mean,
you're not always going to make a good decision.
Sometimes Cinnabon's the only place that's open, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So when it comes to movement, exercise and stuff like that, what do you say you tailor that with particular people? Because obviously someone who's got, you know, knee replacements are not going to be running or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest barriers is joint pain, for sure, right? People who have really bad osteoarthritis. But I think about exercise, and very interestingly, generationally, people have very different opinions. Like, for instance, women who are in their 70s, I really have a hard time convincing that they should be sweating. It's just something that's just not going to happen, you know? And it's just very interesting versus people who sometimes come in their 30s, I almost have to get them to slow down. Like they're doing like crazy boot camps and HIIT exercises and they're almost like stressing their body out too much, particularly for women. I see that a lot. So, and that's like the spectrum of in between. So I think of exercise in four ways. There's cardio, right? Hands on our hips, sweating.
Yep.
There's strength training, which is like lifting weights. There's flexibility training, which is like yoga, Pilates, balance exercises. And then there's something called NEAT, which is actually not exercise, but non-exercise activity thermogenesis. This is movement, right? Going for a walk, I don't know, cleaning your windows, dancing, mowing the lawn, right?
Okay.
And I sort of think about adding it in reverse order. So you got to move, right? If you're sitting all day on the computer at your job, and then you come home and watch Netflix for 4 hours, we got to do something, right? Start going for walks, start using the stairs, start moving. Next is stretching, right? A lot of people have neck pain, joint pain, back pain. You got to stretch, you know, heat it up, stretch out, feel a way to get a little bit looser. Then adding in strength training. And then lastly, trying to do crazy cardio where you're like really sweating and, you know, adding in hours on the treadmill.
What do you think is the most important part of all that? Like or do you have to do all of them? Do you think it's...
I think you do what people want to do, right? So, I mean, I have three kids, and I mean, I'm not working out. I mean, the recommendation's like 150 minutes a week to like keep your main of cardio.
I feel like I walk 150 minutes a week at least, right? So I'm like, I'm probably getting some cardio there.
Right? I know. So I don't think I quite hit the 150 of cardio, but I do some strength training, right? And so if a mom comes to me like, look, all I got is 20 minutes twice a week, I'm like, fine, lift weights, take your kids out and go play with them in the park and do these, like, you know, I only have isolated of 20 minutes, then it's like, then move, take your kids out to the park, go for a walk, get your family moving, right? Do jumping jacks while they're playing and just keep going and be okay with that and see if that works. You know, find the barriers that are preventing you from doing those things and let's talk them out and be honest. And I think, honestly, for exercise in particular, it really is working with your partner to kind of find that balance of being like, you know, I'm working out Monday, Wednesday, you're working out Tuesday, Thursday, and we're doing this, right? We're going to get healthier together. Because yeah. I think sometimes it can get a little one-sided if a partner comes in and they're like, I'm going to be in the gym 3 hours every week. And the other person's sort of like, okay, like, you know, it kind of has to be a little bit of a communication and an open conversation about what works with the family, what doesn't work, and kind of finding those different barriers.
Yeah, I know. So when I talked to Jason Fung, we talked about intermittent fasting. So I decided to just try fasting and it was surprisingly easy. I think I thought it'd be really
it's
hard.
Shockingly easy.
Like
it?
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, I just basically just didn't eat. I mean, it's, I got hungry for a little bit and then it went away and, you know, and so I was doing it like 36 hours. So yeah, I would just, wow. Yeah. Cause I thought, I wonder if I could do it. It was sort of not like, look, I'm not climbing mountains, right? I was just, seeing if I could not eat for a while.
Right.
But it became really difficult from a social standpoint. Like, you know, I'm sitting at the table and I'm eating, well, I'm not eating anything and I'm just sitting at the table, everyone's talking and I'm like drinking a glass of water. And so socially it became really complicated. So now I just make it so I just eat once a day.
Yeah.
Except on weekends, because then with the whole family.
Now
and
you're having breakfast, right? Saturday breakfast, whatever, with your family.
Right. I mean, so it just like...
Yeah.
That's what... And the nice thing is it doesn't matter. But is that sort of like what do you recommend for people doing? I mean, when it comes to stuff like that? Is that the part of the working out, making sure it fits your schedule and making sure it fits things?
I mean, I think I think it's just finding... being honest with ourselves and finding things that work and make sense and then kind of keep pushing it to meeting whatever goals and expectations you have. You know, that's one of our aspects of our program is we try to help people kind of present up front where they want to be, right? So if your goal is that you want to run a marathon, but you only plan on running once a week, you're probably not going to meet that goal, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really having women come in, talk about what goals they want in a couple of different facets of health, and then kind of laying out a very clear plan of if that's obtainable and how we can get from point A to point B. And then we provide the resources that we need to get there.
And now you've talked all about women because it's a women's clinic that you're going to be joining, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But I assume now you're not just doing women's.
So now my current practice,
you do men and women. Uh-huh. Probably more women than men is my guess. For weight loss, is that accurate?
Actually, no, that's actually probably not accurate.
Not accurate.
So maybe like 60-40.
Yeah, right. I mean, I wouldn't think it's like 70-30, but I would say it's still skews towards women. How are they different? I mean, than men.
Yeah.
Like, what's the difference? I mean, we're obviously in the United States, so I'm sure there are lots of cultural differences.
Yeah.
Like motivations.
It's unfortunately very unfair for women because I will have men that come in and make some small changes and really lose a lot of weight quickly. you know, you have patients who are like, I just stopped drinking soda and I've lost 30 pounds. And you're like, oh my gosh, that really, don't tell your wife. I think that's one of the differences is that when men get it right, it tends to be easy. I'm like, if they're moving and eating what their body wants, then weight comes off, right? Versus women, as Dr. Bittner has alluded to, there's a lot of hormonal issues that sometimes women are like, I am eating very healthy and I work out a lot. Why is this weight not coming off? And that's one of the challenges that we have with women is that there are sometimes different hormonal issues, stress, sleeping patterns, you know, their phase of ovarian function that can prevent them from getting to their weight goals.
And so that's why it's more than just medication, it's more than exercise. There's more involved than just...
A few things, right? Diving deep into kind of all this different stuff that make up a person.
It is interesting. I mean, this is totally unrelated, yet sort of related, in that I do nerve blocks on people for bowel surgery. And so it's a transabdominal plane block. So tap blocks. We basically just put it between the two muscle layers there, the transverse abdominis and then their internal obliques. Anyway, that's where the nerves run. They sort of like your intercostal nerves.
Okay.
In your abdomen. But it's really interesting because when I do the ultrasound scan, because you have to do an ultrasound, the weight distribution is so dramatically different between men and women. Mm-hmm. Like I'll have guys with gigantic bellies, and then I do the block and their muscles maybe like half an inch or an inch under their skin. I mean, they're almost all deconditioned, all these people, so they don't have big muscles. Mm-hmm. And the women, it's like a mile down because it's all subcutaneous. It's like the men's fat is generally... intra-abdominally.
More visceral fat, yeah.
And for women, it tends to be, extra-abdominal or whatever.
Which I think we know, but I don't think it's thought as much in the medical community. I mean, these are all different pathways of gaining weight, right? So when we say weight and fat, they're all different pathways.
Yeah, sure.
And so men do tend to have a lot more visceral fat, which is kind of the bigger belly that we see, which is fat around the organs. And that's why I think it's usually dietary changes, right? So you're eating the wrong things, your liver's unhappy, it's not doing the right things, and then you get you develop insulin resistance, and then you get fat kind of around your organs. So I think as time goes on, I hope and pray that we'll recognize these pathways more, and then we'll be able to have more formal diagnosis and have more tests that we can say, oh, this is what it is, this is the medicine treatment plan, or you need more nutritional treatment plan, and kind of these different phases, versus just the, eat less, move more kind of mantra.
Right. So that's always been the traditional thing, right? The elf diet, right? Eat less food. How do you approach people when they come in? Like a woman comes in, she said, I've got 20 pounds I absolutely need to lose. Yeah. I've been trying for 3-4 years. I've tried, a couple pills. I tried diet shakes or whatever. I mean, I'm sure people have tried all these things before they come to a doctor, right?
Yeah, they do. Sometimes people come in completely fresh, they're sort of like, oh, I didn't know I needed to lose weight.
So how long is your initial assessment? Is it like an hour? Do you sit down with
them? Yeah, we send people for an hour. And that's really how long it takes, I think, to learn about someone, learn about their relationship with food, learn about different aspects of their life that are really important. So very interestingly, people who have gone through major traumas actually have a harder time losing weight and actually have changes in their hypothalamus that probably change their energy set point. So that will prevent them from getting to their weight goals. And so sometimes it's helpful just to understand how different things in their life have affected them and kind of understanding what different medicines they're on and why, and seeing if we can make changes in an appropriate and safe way. So it takes about an hour to kind of collect all that information and then come up with a plan, because you want a plan that makes sense and that the patient agrees with.
Sure.
And that's where a lot of that motivational interviewing comes in.
And how do you coordinate with... Because you presume you're not doing all the primary care for the patient, right? I mean, so they're on hypertensive medications, they're on some thyroid medications, whatever. There are other things.
Yeah.
It's always dangerous as a specialist, right? Just kind of tossing people on drugs, taking them off drugs. How do you sort of manage that with other physicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the fun things about being an internist is that's what we do.
Sure. Okay.
We're sort of the quarterbacks of all those things, and I'm pretty skilled in doing all that stuff anyway. And so you make adjustments as needed and as we see fit. So I think that's one of the great things about being an internist and having a background doing obesity medicine and being an internist is that I feel pretty comfortable managing all those things. But it takes time, right, to make all those choices. I'm sorry, make all those decisions and talk them out with patients in a safe way.
And then, the other question is, if they have their regular doctor, I always hear that question. I'm like, I think it's funny. They say,
doctor?
No, they always, they say, well, my regular doctor, whatever. Anyway, it's like, well,
my regular doctor.
That's a surgeon here.
right.
Lots of doctors all over. We're regular. I mean, I don't know. We're irregular. Unless we're So they probably have someone there coming from their normal primary care. So
we're acting as a consultant.
You're not assuming the role of the primary care now, usually, are you?
If people want to,
that's what you do.
We have a primary care path. If that's what you want and you want help with all those different things, we're here to help you.
Okay. Yeah. So they can just get the whole package.
The whole package.
And then do you look at your practice? Well, I mean, you haven't started yet, so catch you in a year. But pretty much just local. Is this something that you see yourself not franchising, but is this like a pathway?
I mean,
Because it's not, I don't, I feel like it's new, right? I mean, it's not something that a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, I do think it's new. I think that kind of this model of, multi-specialty practices aren't new.
Well, sure.
Which is basically what we have. But I think focusing on particularly women's health in a multi-specialty way, I think is new. I think our focus on wellness is very new, right? Of getting women to, sit down, review their goals, and providing a very organized structural plan for them. And I think that when you take it from a position of wellness and it's patient-driven is different than you're coming in, I'm checking my box. Like, I have the boxes to check of making sure I check all the different things that need to be done, and then the visit's over.
Right.
I think that is new. And so, you know, I think time will tell. I think we're trying to help as many women as we possibly can. And we hope that people will kind of embrace the different aspects of TRU, which, you know, I know you've reviewed with Dr. Bittner, but sort of our insight into reviewing women's subjective symptoms with SEEDS and our different plans that we call waypoints is kind of a new process.
Right. And so then finally, the word healthy comes up in these conversations all the time, right? What does it mean to be healthy? Because everyone always says, well, I want to be healthy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what is healthy?
How
do you define it?
I think that that's how a patient defines it, right?
Okay.
I think a patient decides what they believe is to be healthy, and we kind of help them get to that goal. Now, we may help adjust some of that based off of, you know, different labs or markers, but honestly, I think that a patient really makes that decision as to what they think is for them is going to be the healthiest for them, the healthiest path for them.
And Cheetos in no way is involved in the healthy lifestyle,
not,
right?
Probably not, but it is a treat. I mean, it's one of those things where I always say you control the food, you don't let food control you, right? So if you're like, I'm having Cheetos today, right? And you have your cup of Cheetos and you enjoy the heck out of it, what can I say? Now, being, you know, you had a terrible day and you're arm deep in Cheetos and all of a sudden half the bag's gone, that's food controlling you. That's not you controlling your Cheeto consumption. So, you know, I always say, I mean, to say that someone isn't going to have dessert ever again is kind of a crappy way to live,
yeah,
right? Like, I mean, to say that you have no outlets for enjoying any of those things, I don't think is realistic, but we have to have that as part of the plan. So part of our plan, we try to have avenues for, we call them treats. So things that wouldn't be necessarily considered a super healthy food, but still able to fit into the plan.
You are allowed to live.
You're allowed to live. Like I said, you control the food. The food does not control you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So patients want to get a hold of you or find out more about you guys. Where do they find you on social media?
Yeah.
Websites?
So our TRU Women's Health is on Facebook, and we have Facebook Lives every Wednesday, which we are free for our patients. And then our website is truewomenshealth.com. And we have a Facebook group, and I think we also have a Twitter. And we're hoping to expand more into TikTok and Twitter when I get started.
So funny. I don't know how Instagram works. I have actually an Instagram account,
yeah,
but I don't get it. I've tried. Yeah. I don't TikTok. But I like how you just like, I think I have a Twitter account. I'm not sure. Right. You are clearly not very well. I don't know. Maybe young people aren't on Twitter now. Are they?
I think they're moving away from Twitter. Right. As my nanny says, it's no one looks at Twitter. It's all about TikTok.
Like Facebook is pretty much perfect demographics for you guys because that's pretty much women who are in their 40s and 50s and maybe late 30s. Right.
Yeah.
But, all right. Well, Dr. Egan, it's been a pleasure. Look forward to seeing what happens with you in the future. And thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, hopefully we can come back with a success report.
Well, I'd love to actually hear that for how you and Diana are doing because, I caught her right before she started or maybe she just started. And now I'm catching you right before you start too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have to come back and you're like, well, this is our empire we built. Just want you to know. Let you know about it.
Yeah, hopefully you won't have one of our former doctors that's like, this is a giant empire that I have to get away from.
It's so big, I just can't. I've lost control.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks again to Dr. Egan. And before we go, let's give another shout out to our sponsor, CareCloud. Don't let bad billing processes keep you from your hard-earned revenue. CareCloud's free revenue cycle assessment uncovers billing mistakes so you can see how to claim every last dollar. Get your free assessment by visiting drpodcastnetwork.com/carecloud. Again, that's drpodcastnetwork.care.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com. We'll be right back.